From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in August of 2003 when the lights went out. Specifically, the country's most extensive blackout began with tree trouble. Those early hours included speculation that you might remember that maybe a terror attack had happened. But in reality, a power line shorted out after making contact with a tree branch. And then there was a cascade of human errors, as explained by New York Times reporter Emily Rube in a recent article. 50 million people were suddenly without power in the Northeast. Now, at the time, we heard all kinds of slurs about our power grid: antiquated, too dependent on certain sources, vulnerable, dangerous. So now, in 2017, do you know how power arrives at your home? Emily Rube's recent piece in the Times is entitled How New York City Gets Its Electricity. But it's about more than just New York City. It's about how energy arrives for all of us and the challenges in both maintaining this system and making it better, taking it into the future. Maybe you're wondering, what about solar or wind or nuclear? All of these questions are addressed in the piece, the kind of piece that helps illustrate one of the most important and complex problems facing us today. But I could have just tweeted a link to this piece. I found myself reading this piece and thinking, number one, it was great journalism. And number two, I felt a much better understanding of how the grid is working now. But I still have a lot of questions about how you go forward here. So I asked Emily Rube to come on the program and take us through the piece. She's on the line with us now. Emily, thanks for taking the time for the program.
Glad to be here.
And Suzanne Hunt is with me in studio. She's from Hunt Green LLC, and she was one of several people listed in that New York Times story as having consulted and worked with Emily throughout the development of that piece. So, Suzanne, thanks for coming in as well on that.
My pleasure. Thanks, Evan.
I want to start, Emily, just with what brought this to your attention in the first place. Why did you get turned on to reporting on this subject?
Well, I've been working on a series of stories to help citizens just understand the complex systems and infrastructure that they use every day and probably take for granted. So I've been exploring things like our water system or our roads. And I don't know about you, but I use electricity every day. And so I decided that that would be an interesting and important subject to tackle. And so, and it turns out it was a lot more complicated than I had originally anticipated.
Listeners, Megan Mack and I will tweet a link to the piece, and it's one that you should flag. There's beautiful illustrations, actually, as well, and really easy to digest. But we'll go ahead and tweet a link to Emily's story that prompted this discussion. And I want to quote from the piece, Emily. You write, quote, "We have a system which is energy inefficient because it was never designed to be efficient," said Richard Kaufman, the state's so-called energy czar, who is leading its plans to reimagine the power grid. "It's like a mainframe computer in the age of cloud computing," Mr. Kaufman added, "and with climate change, the state has to rethink that basic architecture." End quote. And I guess the first thing I wonder there, Emily, is whether it's viable to rebuild this architecture. You know, because you can't scrap and start new. We have to keep the lights on as you do this. But the fact that you can't scrap and start new, you know, does that create a barrier to entry for renewable forms or other forms? Does that make it a lot harder to get change done?
Oh, absolutely. You know, just to, you know, step back for a minute, right now the way that the system works is that we have, you know, hundreds of generating plants that are scattered across the state, mostly actually upstate. And so you have these very large and generating facilities that are producing energy from natural gas, from oil, from nuclear plants that has to travel, through a large system of high voltage transmission lines. There are about 11,000 miles of transmission lines that then take power and deliver it to your local utility, which then operates its own local its own distribution networks. And so you have a massive system that has multiple stakeholders and owners that are, you know, that have to keep the lights on while being cognizant of things like carbon emissions and greenhouse gases. And so, you know, this is just an unbelievably complicated task at hand.
Listeners, I would say this is a good opportunity for you this hour to get some questions answered. If you've got questions about how our grid works, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. This obviously matters because climate change is a challenge we have to tackle. It matters because You know, it impacts your bills, how much you're paying, the efficiency or lack thereof. It matters if you care about renewables. And Suzanne Hunt, I assume it matters because if we were starting from scratch today, there's no way the grid would look like this that it does today, right?
Exactly.
So So what's the challenge then in getting the grid close enough to where we're probably not going to have an ideal situation for a long time? But what's, you know, for you, what is the biggest challenge in getting that movement done that you want to see, the direction you want to see the grid going?
Well, I just want to back up and say, you know, we were talking before the show about what a challenge it is to have this big clunky system and expensive system in place that still needs to be maintained. And in the article, we talk about the billions and billions of dollars needed to invest to upgrade the transmission lines. But any entrepreneur who hears the word problem says, ooh, there's an opportunity. There's a problem there that I could probably create a business to solve. The electricity system is complicated because of, you know, it's highly regulated because it's providing an absolutely essential service that's needed to keep the hospitals running, you know, et cetera. So it's not something you can experiment with unless you have lots and lots of backup systems to make sure that your experimentation doesn't cause any problems. So, you know, one of the ways that I think we're going to get through this transition without raising costs, and we also quote in the article Audrey Zibelman, who says if we do this right, people's electricity costs won't go up. And one of the ways we're going to do that is that because it's such an inefficient system right now, because so many of these power plants, these gas plants are sitting there most of the time, the peaker plants not being used, you know, it's essentially like, building a 16-lane highway just for 3 holidays per year. You're only going to use, 3 holidays per year. So understanding where those inefficiencies are, dramatically improving the inefficiencies while we bring on these new cleaner power sources, while we bring more storage online and make this system much more distributed and resilient, that's a really exciting for an entrepreneur. That's a really exciting opportunity.
Okay. And, you know, I think you, whether it's yourself or the many people I've talked to about, dealing with climate when it comes to market solutions, you know, it's not just a buzzword for conservatives who may be more on the fence about this. You really do see opportunity here?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, the number of companies and number of entrepreneurs that are creating software solutions. A lot of people get excited about the sexy, the solar panels and the sexy technologies. But a lot of the solutions are on the demand side. You know, one of my frustrations regularly is that people are always focused on the supply side and not the demand side. So when we look at the demand side, for example, just to give people an example for their home. When I lived in Washington, I signed a contract with my utility to let them turn my thermostat. To let them put a smart thermostat in my home and then turn it up or down a few degrees a couple times a year if they needed to shave off their peak when there were peak times of demand, either peak need for peak heat or peak cooling. I never nociedd it, and they would give me $100 back a year. Myself and tens of thousands of other people also agreed, and they were able to slightly change our thermostats and then not have to turn a whole power plant on. So that saved a huge amount of money. And so that's where you see people's electricity prices going down with these software solutions.
That's a very innovative way. I mean, you get $100. You say you don't notice it. It didn't happen that often. They weren't remotely playing with
your thermostat. No, I mean, you can literally say, yes, I'll allow you to do it, but only once a year. Or yes, you can do it, three times a year. And I never noticed it.
Is that coming to our thermostats here?
And this is the thing where, traditionally utilities have not seen us as customers. Like most businesses are customer focused. They see us as meters. And so now with all these new companies and new technologies that threaten to undermine their business, with people looking at going completely off grid, they actually have to start being customer focused and offering us these new and interesting options.
Yeah. I mean, so often, Emily, we hear win-win and it's, sort of a zero-sum game. You don't really believe it's win-win. But in this case, Suzanne gets $100 a year. She doesn't really notice when they're fooling around with their thermostat remotely. And all of a sudden, they are much more efficient. Your article points out how inefficient. I thought her 16-lane highway 3 times a year is a really good way to describe it. Your article was a surprise for me, just how often things sit idle in this world.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's exactly one of the biggest problems, as Suzanne pointed out, is that this system was built essentially for the worst case scenario and the few days a year when everybody is cranking their air conditioners. And so, the statistic is, that's thrown about is that the system is idle about 54% of the system is sort of sitting around waiting for these very hot days. And so Suzanne mentioned something about something called peaker plants, which are essentially power plants. In New York City, we have them dotted around the waterfront here, and they're only switched on, you know, on the hottest days of the year. Some of them are sitting on barges off the coast of Brooklyn, just waiting for that event when, you know, when the utilities have to deliver power to make sure that people get to go home to a cool apartment and a cold beer.
And I also want to say I have to give credit to the New York Battery and Energy Storage Association. I heisted that 16-lane highway analogy from their energy storage roadmap. So credit where credit's due.
Oh, you're so ethical. That's very nice of you to cite your sources. I'm going to take go ahead, Emily.
Well, it's just the you know, so here you have a massive system. You know, we have to keep the lights on, as Suzanne pointed out. We have critical you know, hospitals and you know, New York City. I mean, the blackout in 2003, you know, that you could actually see a dip in the GDP for that year. It cost the, you know, the country about $6 billion. And so that is what makes this situation or this transformation such a high-stakes game, because the grid as it is today, you know, the way that it works is that energy is consumed seconds after it is produced. And so, as Suzanne was pointing out about the development of batteries and storage, that is going to be a critical component of the grid's transformation, which, you know, we're seeing some of now, but, you know, the technology is not yet where we need it to be if we're going to, you know, rely on things like wind and solar, which are intermittent.
Well, on that note, I want to take a few listener questions and comments here. I'm going to start on the phones. I've got a small pile of your emails, and we're going to be working through that. Brian, your email, we'll get to it after Rick's phone call. It's about a kind of a pie chart. He wants to know what's the breakdown of how energy is powered now versus, you know, what could it be in the future? It's a great question. I think Rick's calling from Bath with a specific question on part of that pie chart, which is how the grid is localized, and a question on solar energy. So go ahead, Rick.
Yeah. From what I understand about the grid, and well, a lot of electricity is it's local. It has to be local because when you start pushing it to distance, you have to run it through transformers and boost it. So electric is it's local, and so development of wind and solar is, I think, is essential because of the, you know, the pushback on fossil fuels and that kind of stuff. And but I have one little tidbit that I thought was interesting to share with you was down here in Sven County, in one of the townships at Harper's Hammondsport, New York. In the local paper, they're having a meeting this next week on a talk about a moratorium on solar installation, which I thought was kind of odd. And I guess that's all I have to add for today.
All right, Rick, thanks for the phone call. I think Suzanne Huntwood might maybe use a different word than odd. I don't know. can you characterize how you feel about that?
You know, it's been incredibly frustrating to watch the counties in upstate New York, many of them working against their citizens' best interests. And, you know, there are a number of concerns that folks have that are very legitimate. You know, there is a land rush for solar leases for huge industrial solar plants that concern people. That's been mainly downstate where electricity prices are much higher. But folks are concerned, and that, you know, we definitely don't want to see hundreds and hundreds of acres, you know, just endless fields of solar panels. We want to do it in a thoughtful way. But seeing towns just knee-jerk and just, you know, moratorium, I think that the Urbana moratorium that they're thinking about is, I've heard that they're just thinking about it for large-scale systems. But even then, you know, so the town that I live in, the town of Jerusalem, just put a solar ordinance in place that limits the size of systems to 0.35. The largest system that can go in is 0.35 acres.
Which is how big, by the way? Can you give us some perspective?
Slightly, you know, I'd have to think it depends on if you need setbacks and all those things. But that's probably the roof space that we have at, that we use at our place for our system at Hunt Country Vineyards at my family's winery. But you know, the size limit for a community shared solar array in New York, for example, is 2 megawatts, and that's going to take you 10 or 12 acres. And so if I want to, and I'm working with a number of communities across upstate New York that want to put in community-owned shared solar arrays so that you can, you know, get a much lower cost because it's much more efficient and your soft costs are much less. And then you can actually offer this low-cost power to especially low-income community members who probably can't, either don't own their home or don't have a strong credit score, so they can't get their own solar. And, you know, so these, a lot of these townships that put in some of these limitations without considering community shared solar and without considering some of these other things. One other thing that I would say is one of the other things that's a big problem in the area is that many, New York State has a property tax exemption for solar and wind. So, and the whole idea is with that is that if you put solar on your home, you shouldn't get, you know, your property taxes jacked way up, because then your solar becomes uneconomic and it'll kill the market for solar. And we want people to become produce their own clean energy. Many of the counties are opting out of that. And, you know, it's been a real problem. People are calling me saying, I just had my tax assessment raised through the roof. No one puts a diesel generator in and gets their property taxes increased, but they put a solar generator in and they get punished. And that's got to stop. Like, we have got to get our tax assessment figured out in these counties.
What's the reason they're doing that? What do they say the reason is?
They say, well, I can't speak for the counties, certainly, but I've heard that they're just cash strapped and they see what they think is a property improvement, even though it's a temporary, you know, it's not, you know, the solar panels are then removed in 30 years or something. But they see a way to bring in short-term revenue, even though long-term it hurts the tax base, because the more citizens who are, you know, producing their own power and not paying money to a foreign-owned utility and keeping that money in the community, that actually strengthens the tax base over time.
And whether it's Urbana or Jerusalem, putting that limit again, 0.35 acre, for example, what did they say? Because that can impact real people and real businesses, could it not? So what did they say the reason is for that kind of a limit?
One of the concerns that some of the folks voiced was they're worried about huge solar arrays ruining the view from the lakes.
Eyesores.
And so my point was, no solar developer is going to pay top dollar for Lakeview property and pay, you know, much higher taxes. It just ruins the economics of the system.
Okay.
So then, you know, and it's also not by definition, you know, most of those sites are going to be on a hillside where it's not going to be optimal sun exposure. So a lot of these things, when people work through them, you know, they're understandable concerns, but when you work through them, they're actually not really a real problem.
I guess we'll see based on whether the regulations and these new laws are passed or not in a lot of these places. Rick, thanks for the phone call from Bath. I want to turn back to Emily Rube, who's on the line with us, a New York Times reporter. You ought to read her piece, How New York City Gets Its Electricity, but it's really about a story about the grid for all of us. And we had an email, Emily, from a listener named Brian, who just wanted to know about what is the actual kind of pie chart breakdown about how energy is delivered now versus what it might be. I'm looking at your piece, and I'll flag a few lines, and then I'll let you kind of expand on it, if that's okay. You know, you write, coal, the original fuel, is on its way out. The state has announced plans to close the remaining plants or convert them to natural gas, which is currently cheap and plentiful. In 2015, 64 plants that use natural gas produced almost half the electricity in the state, said the New York Independent System Operator. 4 nuclear plants accounted for about a third of it. And in New York, there are 180 hydroelectric facilities which produce 19% of the state's electricity. According to the latest figures, less than a quarter of the electric energy produced in New York came from renewables. While there are tens of thousands of residential and commercial solar energy systems, only one utility-scale solar photovoltaic power plant is included in the NYISO's estimates of solar production. Large-scale wind has had more success, and the state is pushing for more. About 30 wind farms are planned for upstate. So that's kind of a broad-based look, but, you know, how would you answer Brian's question on, you know, what a pie chart might look like right now versus where it might be going?
So right now we get about half of our electricity, or at least half of the electricity that's produced in New York State comes from natural gas, which, as I said in the piece, is cheap and plentiful. So, you know, part of the cost of electricity is the original fuel source that is used. Nuclear, which we have been relying on for its carbon-free power still remains, a very, very important piece in our electricity arsenal, so to speak. But New York State has set pretty ambitious goals to have about 50% of the energy that we consume in the state to come from renewables by 2030. So right now we're at about 23%, but the state is looking to build, offshore wind. There's a contract to build the nation's largest offshore wind farm. That's set for the waters between the eastern tip of Long Island and Martha's Vineyard. And so they're saying that could power 50,000 homes, on Long Island by, 2022. And so we are seeing a shift towards more renewable sources. The big question is what's going to happen once Indian Point nuclear power plant shuts down. The governor has announced plans to close that plant, citing safety concerns. And, of course, nuclear isn't a perfect fuel either because, disposing of the radioactive waste is still an issue. But nuclear, the state wants to subsidize the plants upstate, and if it closes the plant down here, which is about 45 miles north of New York City, and provides about a quarter of the electricity that New York City and Westchester consume, they're going to have to start accelerating some of their other plans to bring in more renewables and or transport it or bring it in from other neighboring grids like Canada, for example. Mm-hmm. So when we look at the pie chart of where New York gets its power, we also have to remember that, New York State is one grid that's embedded in the North American or the Eastern interconnection, which is one of three main grids in that blankets North America. And so New York State has the ability to bring in power from, from as far away as Saskatchewan. And so right now they're looking at ways to bring in power, more hydroelectric power from Canada. And that's the other piece about New York State, which we're very lucky, unlike other states that are sort of landlocked. New York State has access to the falls and the lakes. And so we have a tremendous amount of opportunity to create hydroelectric power. And actually, New York State was one of the first hydroelectric power stations or large-scale hydroelectric power stations that propelled Buffalo into, sort of an industrial force. The way that when we think about, providing power or producing power, it really will take a full complement of all of these sources to keep the lights on, essentially.
And let me turn to Suzanne Hunt just to follow up on this. And I want to read a bit of a piece from about a month ago. Producer Megan Mack grabbed this piece for us last night from CNBC. A lot of people thought, with the election of Donald Trump, we're going to see a real roadblock for renewable energy, for solar, probably a push to go back to more carbon sources. Here's the headline from CNBC, Why Donald Trump Won't Hold Back Solar and Wind Power. Let me read from this and see what Suzanne thinks. Quote, goals adopted by more than half of U.S. states are what's driving growth in renewable energy projects, and Trump will have little effect on these efforts. There are more corporations pledging to draw power from renewable sources, and lawmakers on both sides of the aisle last month renewed subsidies for solar and wind energy farms. The new president made clear in his 2015 book, Crippled America, that he believes renewable energy is a bad investment. Even developing alternative forms of energy from renewable sources is a, quote, big mistake, he said. And Trump writes in his book, quote, to begin with, the whole push for renewable energy is being driven by the wrong motivation, the mistaken belief that global climate change is being caused by carbon emissions. If you don't buy that, and I don't, then what we really have is just an expensive way of making the tree huggers feel good about themselves. He did not win a Pulitzer for this writing. But let me finish this from CNBC. In its latest annual energy outlook, the U.S. Energy Information Administration projected renewable energy consumption will grow faster than any other source through 2040 because capital costs fall as more solar and wind farms crop up and federal and state policies encourage their construction. Currently, 29 states have renewable fuel standards, and they have not backed away from those commitments. And the White House has little influence on state and local rules for solar and wind projects, end quote. So maybe the short version is you're worried, but, you know, maybe states have more control to continue moving forward with these. Are you concerned or do you agree here that, you know, we're going to have more local control than people may fear under a Trump administration, Suzanne?
Well, New York State has made it perfectly clear that we're going to, you know, forge ahead, and so we're very fortunate to be New Yorkers. You know, one thing that I would distinguish for listeners is when we're talking about solar, wind, geothermal, biomass, micro hydro, this whole portfolio of renewable energy technologies. These are technologies, so their costs over time act very differently than commodities. When we talk about coal, oil, natural gas, those price structures are driven primarily by the commodity price structure. And those commodity prices tend to be, at least for oil and gas, very volatile over time. So the companies, you know, all these huge companies like Apple, like, you know, these six, Amazon, these other companies that are committing to procure 100% of their power from renewables are not dumb. They're doing that because they know that the cost curves are going to have gone down dramatically. They know they're going to keep going down. They know that they're predictable. And they can lock in. I mean, their ability to budget, you know, 5, 10, 15 years in the future changes dramatically. And so not only are these the end cost of the power becoming competitive, but they have enormous certainty. So that technology versus commodity is a huge benefit to the clean technology side. And I would also say, referencing the last question about the pie chart, you know, the energy mix in states and countries can change very rapidly. So if you looked at the U.S. even a few years ago, it was 50% coal power for the electricity sector, and now that's down to maybe 30%. New York State, it wasn't that long ago that we had coal plants all over the state. Now I think Emily and I were trying to figure this out.
Yeah,
I think there's
three or four left,
and they'll be gone soon too. So these things, I think, you know, you tend to think these big infrastructure things change slowly. But, you know, think of landline phones and cell phones. The transitions happen really fast when they become competitive. And the interesting thing that's happening now is that, you know, solar wind, part of why Trump can't kill clean tech is because it's competing on its own merits now.
Kurt, go ahead, Emily.
Well, the one thing I will add about renewable sources is that this is where storage becomes sort of the holy grail because, you know, so upstate, there is something called the New York Independent System Operator, where they're actually balancing how much power is being produced and consumed pretty much instantaneously. And so in order to make sure that there is no disruption of power, they have to predict how much power is going to be coming out of each power plant. And the challenge with wind and solar for specifically, is that they are less predictable than a nuclear plant or a natural gas plant. So they're working to develop technologies that will be able to better predict the output for each of these, you know, wind farms or solar plants. And so that just adds another variable and another layer of complexity when we think about, you know, adding these renewables while they are, yes, as Suzanne pointed out, you know, less vulnerable to, you know, price spikes on the commodities markets. But they are also, you know, you can't force the wind to blow when you want it to or the sun to shine.
But you can balance them out using the grid. I mean, the grid starts to become, and actually, when after the break, we're going to pull in our colleague Jim Gallagher, who's worked on the New York State electricity system for the last 30 years. And we actually met on a trip we took to Germany to study their grid and their energy transition about 3 years ago. And one of the things that you find is when you have distributed generation, when you have thousands and thousands of energy generations distributed around, your grid acts like a kind of battery, and your grid management and all those demand-side management tools act in a way like storage, and they help you balance the grid. So you don't, it's not like, you know, the wind blows identically in one place, you know, everywhere. So that's the idea with And one of the huge benefits is distributed generation. And then bringing in new sources like offshore wind. Offshore wind near New York City, it's right to the one caller's question about line loss. You know, you are going to lose something between 5 and 10% of the electricity in transmission. So when you produce it right near where it's used, it's helpful. And when you have something like offshore wind, the wind currents are much more consistent. It's much more like baseload, and it's close to where it's needed.
All right. Kurt writes to the program and says, the absurdity of the eyesore excuse for solar. When I see spans of solar panels or a number of wind turbines, I'm enthralled. I find them fascinating, and I love how they look. High rises and billboards and concrete barriers that dot the landscape. Now that is the eyesore. That's from Kurt. We're going to get to your phone calls. In fact, here's what we're going to do. Let me just reset the hour for you. We're talking about a piece in the New York Times, how New York City gets its electricity. But it's not just New York City. It's really all of us here in New York State. And we're thinking about the future of the grid. Obviously, if you could redesign it from scratch, it would look very different than it does today. The challenge is getting there while keeping the lights on. And that's part of this process. We're learning a lot from New York Times reporter Emily Rube, who's on the line with us. Suzanne Hunt from Hunt Green LLC, who consulted with Emily for some background information on this reporting. And we'll take this break. We're going to come back later this hour. We're going to hear from Jim Gallagher from the New York State Smart Grid Consortium. And we've got a couple more listener questions. And so if you're waiting on the phone, we'll get your calls right after the only break of the hour on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're joined by author Brian Alexander, the author of the new book, Glass House, The 1% Economy and the Shattering of the All-American Town. He's from Lancaster, Ohio, a town that Forbes magazine used to call the All-American Town decades ago. It had glass factories, a lot of people working in manufacturing. What happened? His story is in many ways rural America's story. We'll talk about it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's try to work quickly through your comments. Carlene in Rochester is next on the phone. Go ahead, Carlene.
Yes. Since I was wondering, since we have all this hydroelectric power up at the falls, why is there not, is there some kind of an artificially controlled way that we in our area do not have greater development and lower costs for manufacturing that would be a real driving force for our economy? Who really owns that power, and are they artificially squeezing us to get higher prices, to sell it to high-priced downstate?
Carlene, thanks for the phone call. Emily, you want to weigh in on that?
Let me make sure I understand the question. So you're asking about transporting hydropower downstate?
Carlene did the whole hang up and listen thing, which is fine. But I think what she's asking is, she's asking who owns the hydropower from Niagara Falls, who distributes it? I don't know if we know plant by plant. Suzanne, you're...
I think it's hard to say because each power plant essentially bids into a daily marketplace that's administered by the New York Independent System Operator. There's about 180 hydroelectric plants around the state. And so each day and each hour, power providers and power plants bid into this so-called day-ahead market and put forward a price about how much, power they can provide at what hour and for how much money. And then the New York Independent System Operator, these are the grid operators that I was talking about earlier, upstate in this massive control room near the Capitol, their computer systems will actually take the lowest bidder for that hour. Now, that's a very simple version of how the power markets work, and so it's not necessarily possible to trace how much each plant or how much where your electricity came from because electrons aren't tagged. But the state right now, and the way that the power markets are structured, and Suzanne, you can chime in here, you probably know more about this than I do, but they're looking for ways to make hydropower more appealing and on these wholesale markets by offering some kind of credit or on the wholesale market, because right now hydro, nuclear, wind, they're all sort of weighted equally. But they want to sort of try and work in a new value structure in the wholesale market so that hydro plants and these other renewable sources can compete in these very competitive wholesale markets.
Okay. And Suzanne, again, do we know who owns that hydro plant?
Yeah, I think Jim can talk more to this, but the NYPA is the organization. New York Power Authority runs the big Niagara Hydro. And a lot of municipalities actually do get very low-cost power from NYPA. I think this is a good time to pull Jim in.
Yeah, let me grab Jim Gallagher on the line. He's with the New York State Smart Grid Consortium. He's been listening to the conversation. And Jim, we appreciate the time. Thanks for joining the program.
You're welcome. And just to add to what Suzanne just said, yes, NYPA has owned those plants for decades, and almost all of that power right now is allocated to municipalities across the state as well as businesses. So it's a major economic development program. In fact, one of the concerns in the past has been the power from those plants is so low cost compared to other sources that it's sometimes a disincentive against doing things such as renewables or energy efficiency. But that, to answer the caller's question, the power is allocated for economic development reasons.
All right. What I want to do, Jim, is I kind of want to open up a question to you because I know you've been listening to the conversation. And I want to let you kind of weigh in on what you've been hearing, but I'll do it with a question from a listener that I think will help us do that. This is from John on Twitter, and he just says, can your guest comment on Governor Cuomo's new REC and ZEC changes? Are they efficient ways to speed the growth of renewables? Jim Gallagher, I'll start with you.
Okay. I believe what he's getting at is zero energy credit programs of the governor's to keep the upstate power plants alive, the nuclear power plants operating. And the governor's objective is to do that for climate reasons because of the carbon emission benefits. So that's a state policy, and you know, without those plants, it would be very, very hard to achieve the state's long-term carbon goals.
Okay, Suzanne Hunt, on that, anything you want to add to the question on if these are good policies to move us in a way toward more renewables?
I think there's no way to answer this question without upsetting someone because it is
that's
a really
right.
Yeah,
it's the best kind of question.
It's a really controversial issue, and there's a lot of different ways to look at it. But no, you know, there are pros and cons to every path forward. And you know, as a governor who had to see a big section of his city go underwater in the Superstorm Sandy, I think he really wanted to make sure we didn't have to fire up a whole lot of natural gas plants. And to some degree, with the nuclear plants, the damage is already done. I mean, the waste is there. I am not an expert on these old nuclear plants by any means, but I think they thought that the least bad option was to keep them running a bit longer while we scale up all of these efficiency, demand side management, and renewables technologies.
Okay. And we did hear from Alan, a listener who just wants to know, are we going to see more nuclear? And if not, why not? Emily, I know in your reporting, you encountered some people along the way that indicated we were moving away from nuclear in the state. Is that correct?
Not necessarily moving away. I think the state recognizes that it provides what's called baseload power, which means that nuclear plants just have an amazing capability to provide a steady amount of carbon-free electricity. And so they're looking to subsidize the nuclear plants upstate. It's just that they want to close the one at Indian Point, which is close to New York City and has had a series of safety violations. I think that the state actually does want to include nuclear so that in its portfolio to balance some of these intermittent sources like wind and solar.
I would just add to that it's the markets that are moving away from nuclear. Nuclear is expensive. And Wall Street hasn't invested in new nuclear plants, except for maybe one or two down south, in 30 years. And so many of these plants are just aging. They're just getting beyond their usable lifetime.
Okay. So a market reaction, in other words, is what you're saying. On Twitter, Thomas wants to know about the town of Parenton. He says, Parenton wants to opt out of the 15-year exemption of property tax exemptions for renewable energies. How can we fight that? Now, Thomas, I'll just say I'm not familiar offhand with anything Parenton's proposed. I'm certainly not doubting what you're saying. I can't speak to that specifically, but I think what he's asking generally is, as a citizen, Suzanne Hunt, you've done a lot of work with, you know, both as a citizen and with citizens on these issues. What would you say to someone like Thomas who's concerned about that?
I think what needs to happen is folks need to get up to speed on these issues. So, you know, it's always helpful to have information sessions, get folks to come who are steeped in this. And you know, whether it's a potluck dinner or you use some of the local public buildings for just an info session, you know, get up to speed on it. And then you really need to talk to your county legislators or whoever the folks are that are making these decisions. They need to hear from their constituents about this and understand that it really is in their constituents' best interest to leave the opt-out in place.
Yeah, I mean, earlier this hour, and I don't think Suzanne had a chance to answer this, so we can hit this again. I asked, you know, again, looking at that pie chart question, how do we power our homes now? How might that change in the future if we can realign the grid in a way that is reasonably efficient and successful over the coming decades? And what are the barriers to getting that done? You know, one of the things clearly is public perception, but I don't know if to you, Suzanne, that means, does the public fully understand this issue, or is it public perception by way of local governments, or is that sort of a combination?
You know, there's a whole mix. You know, it's such a diverse mix of you have folks that have, you know, are passionate about this and, you know, can tell you all kinds of, you know, they've been studying it in their spare time. And then you have folks that just don't, you know, they haven't been exposed to it. And then you have a lot of folks who've heard lots of misinformation. And this is nothing new, and this isn't some kind of conspiracy theory. It's very common for existing industries to fight the new guys by spreading misinformation. So, you know, when Rockefeller was making his fortune with Standard Oil Corporation 100 years ago, and his first product was kerosene for lamps, when Tesla and Edison invented electricity, Rockefeller funded this huge misinformation campaign to make people think electricity was dangerous so they wouldn't switch to electric light from his heating oil, or his lamp oil. So this is nothing new. And so the fossil fuel industry has been funding to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars these misinformation campaigns. So it is not in any way surprising that folks are confused about this.
Yeah, I would go back. Listeners, my favorite episode of the Neil deGrasse Tyson version of Cosmos was on lead and what happened with lead when it comes to actual scientists testifying and members of Congress and what they spent years trying to convince people about lead that was turned out to be not true and very dangerous. So I take the historical point that Suzanne is making there. I'm going to throw Jim back on hold just for 1 second because, see if I can do that. Rob, can you help me with that? Let's put Jim on hold for 1 second. I want to grab a phone call in Rochester from Keith. So as soon as we get Jim on hold, you talk about, we need a grid upgrade here at WXXI. That's what we probably need to do. There we go. Watch this. There we go. Let's see if I've done it. Keith, are you there?
I'm here.
I've done it. Who needs solar panels on the roof of WXXI when I am operating the phones? Go ahead, Keith.
Interesting show, but I'd like to ask your guest. The problem with wind is you make it, you know, if you need it and you can't make it, or if you really can't store it other than batteries. But is the state looking into, like I know Germany is, of producing as much electricity as needed, taking the extra electricity, running it through water, distilling water into hydrogen and oxygen, venting off the oxygen, saving the hydrogen, and then burning the hydrogen at a later time, and with the byproduct of hydrogen is water. They do it. I know Germany is looking into it. I mean, theoretically, you'd have an endless supply of
Keith, do you know just a little? Do you know just enough to be dangerous on this, or do you know what you're talking about? And I mean that with affection.
Well, no, a little bit of both. Okay. I consider myself informed, but theoretically, it's possible to do it on a larger scale.
Okay.
It can be done, but the problem is there a will to do it?
Well, thank you for the phone call, Keith. It's a very interesting question. Suzanne Hunt, you want to jump in? Go ahead.
Keith just brought up a whole, I think he kind of answered his own question. You know, yes, renewables can be intermittent, the sun and the wind, but there are all kinds of ways to store it. So New York State, for example, has pumped hydro. You know, we will take wind energy that's blowing at night when there's not a huge demand for electricity, pump water uphill, and then run it downhill to produce electricity during the day. So there, it's not just we're not just talking about batteries. We're talking about pumped hydro. Keith thought what he pointed out is there are ways to take electricity and turn it into gaseous fuels, which you just use store and use later. So when we talk about storage, we don't talk about just batteries. We talk about all kinds of storage methods, and Keith just brought up one of them.
Well, and this may be a good opening, Keith. Thank you for that. As we get about 5 minutes left to ask all of our guests to kind of do what Emily Rube did in her piece, which is ask what is next. And Emily, you know, you write in the piece, instead of moving power from large central generating stations where energy flows in only one direction and about 5% vanishes in transit, more power will be generated and distributed locally. But what's the extend that for me? When you write about what's next there, and we really do want to get more efficient, you know, how are we going to do that? Or at least what does your reporting tell us about what we should expect?
So at the beginning of the program, we talked about Richard Kaufman, New York State's energy czar, comparing the state's grid to a mainframe computer in the age of cloud computing, right? So in the same way, you know, we're using smartphones, for example, and laptops that have sort of revolutionized how we get and store information, the grid of the future is going to have more and more smaller scale generating units and storage devices that are throughout the grid. So you will reduce the distance that a power has to travel from where it's consumed and made. And that is also, you know, the hope is that it's going to make the system more efficient and more resilient. So instead of having these large centralized power generating stations upstate and this large network of high voltage cables that have to carry the power downstate, more of it is going to be produced in communities, and consumers are going to have the ability to produce their own power, and so you're going to have a grid that is going to transport power in two directions, essentially. And so the idea being is that we will have access we will have more control over how our power is made and consumed.
Okay. Let me ask Jim Gallagher that same question from the New York State Smart Grid Consortium. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, one of the things that we want to do, and by we, I mean collectively across the state, is make utilities more nimble. And nimble is usually not a word. It's associated with utilities. But make them more nimble at integrating distributed energy resources into their normal way of operating the business. And the way we're trying to do that and the way we're encouraging utilities is to actually create more of a local marketplace for consumers, that consumers can very easily shop for alternative sources of energy, whether it's solar or demand side management or load management, but to have the utilities really play an active role working with customers and really, you know, putting customers in charge of making the decision, but making sure the utilities put the platform in place to do that.
Sure. And if my utility wants to give me $100 a year to play with the thermostat remotely a couple times, I'm down. Suzanne Hunt, some final thoughts from you. Go ahead.
Well, in addition to the local marketplace concept that Jim just brought up, you know, I also want to stress, and I think I've stressed this on your show before, the aspect of local ownership. You know, one of the callers wanted to know about economic development in the context of energy. You know, being able to produce our own energy is the biggest economic development opportunity I have seen for upstate New York in a very, very, very long time. You know, instead of spending, our businesses spending, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, or, you know, and our state spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on power to investor-owned utilities. And last time I checked, all of them were foreign-owned in New York State. You know, the one we have in our area is owned by a Spanish company. You know, instead of all of that money leaving, if we keep that in the state, it's going to have huge implications.
Jim Gallagher, New York State Smart Grid Consortium, thanks for joining us by phone this hour. We appreciate it, Jim.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome.
In studio, Suzanne Hunt from Hunt Green LLC. Nice seeing you again. Thank you for being here, Suzanne. You're looking at your watch going, I cannot believe that's the hour.
That
happens to you every time you come on this. That's what happens on Connections. It flies. Emily Rube, New York Times reporter, really tremendous journalism. Congratulations on that. Thanks for bringing this story to us and for taking the time for the program today.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And listeners, again, you can check out Emily's work. We'll make sure that we post that in various places, including on our social media. Had a lot of great questions from listeners about the grid, how it works, what's coming next, and got to as many of those as we could here. Let's get a break and more connections straight ahead.